Ottawa, Algonquin Territory.
Penticton, British Columbia, on traditional Siksik territory.
Winnipeg, traditional territory of the Nahiawak and Nakota, Treaty 1 territory and traditional homeland of the Métis Nation.
Calgary, Alberta, the traditional lands of the Treaty 7 people, as well as the unrecognized lands of the Métis Nation.
This episode of Groundwire was brought to you by volunteers at Kootenai Cooperative Radio on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, BC.
In this episode,
Groundwire speaks with Splatson community members opposed to the transfer of land that is known to be an ancestral burial ground.
A sacred walk protesting the proposed Zibi condominium project, a massive residential, commercial, and retail development at Chaudière and Albert Islands in Ottawa.
Almost 5 decades after a pulp and paper mill dumped at least 9 tons of mercury into the English Wabagoon River system, nothing has been done to clean it up. In June, over 1,000 people took part in the annual River Run protest at Queen's Park in Toronto. Here are the headlines.
The inquest into the deaths of 7 First Nations youth who moved to Thunder Bay from northern communities to attend school between 2001 and 2011 has come to a close with 145 recommendations. Many of the recommendations echo those of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and include addressing inequities in education funding, addressing inadequate housing and poverty experienced by children and youth on reserve, and conducting individualized needs assessments for youth attending school in Thunder Bay to address their mental health, health, and academic needs. The inquest began in 2007 but was stalled while a separate legal challenge regarding the low representation of Indigenous people on juries was being heard at the Supreme Court of Canada. The jury deemed 3 of the youth's deaths as accidental and 4 undetermined. 3 of the youth whose deaths were undetermined drowned in the river, and the police's investigation has been called into question and deemed deeply flawed, as there wasn't enough evidence to determine if the youth were drowned deliberately. A youth that testified during the inquest described surviving after being thrown in the river by a group of strangers. As the inquest comes to a close, concerns remain about the high levels of racist harassment and violence faced by the First Nations youth living in Thunder Bay. Leadership from many communities whose youth attend school in Thunder Bay are hopeful that the recommendations will be implemented quickly so that First Nations youth can access quality education in their own communities or safely access education in Thunder Bay. Many of these recommendations were also cited following an inquest into a death of a First Nations youth 20 years ago, but there's been a lack of support to implement the recommendations. As these recommendations are not legally binding, nor is anyone charged with the responsibility of implementing them.
The government of British Columbia's 2016 Crown Contaminated Sites Report was released recently, and it shows a sharp increase in provincial liability for cleaning up of contaminated industrial crown land. The Contaminated Sites Regulation requires the province to remediate an industrial site if it is high risk and the operating company has gone bankrupt or no longer exists, or if the site has defaulted back to ownership of the province. This year's report shows that the province is now liable for $508 million in costs, an increase of $224 million over the past 2 years. But Andrew Gage, a lawyer with West Coast Environmental Law, says most of this is a result of changes to how those sites are evaluated. Many of the high-risk contaminated sites detailed in the report involve abandoned mines, pulp mills, and other heavy industrial sites in rural areas. However, they also exist in cities. For example, the ongoing remediation of the former Expo 86 location in Vancouver's False Creek, where the province has already spent $68 million to remediate the soil and clean groundwater as part of a development deal with Concord Pacific. The BC government has previously estimated there might be close to 2,000 contaminated sites on private and provincial land across the province, and this figure could double if you include contaminated properties in which the federal government carries liability. Carol Bellringer, the BC Auditor General, released a report in May noting that there is currently a $1.2 billion shortfall in the amount of securities that mining companies have posted with the provincial government versus estimated cleanup costs if they abandon their projects.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
You just heard an excerpt from Hunt the Circle by Alberta composer and musician Kathleen Yearwood. Yearwood played recently at Cassetet, a festival of experimental music which takes place each June in Prince George, BC.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
The chief of the Spotsin First Nation in Interior British Columbia has entered into a settlement agreement process with the Government of Canada for the transfer of unceded Spotsin land, which is known to be an ancestral burial ground. A number of Spotsin community members oppose this transfer and, on the urging of elders in the community, are struggling to ensure the transfer does not take place. In this next feature, Gunarji O'Sullivan speaks with Spotsin community members Jody Leon and Goyotsis about this proposed transfer and its implications.
So in 1877, our historical chiefs had let the Canadian government know that the ancestral remains were part of the actual Spotsin Reserve. At that time in 1877, the chiefs had very clearly said that the ancestral remains which lie at the base of one of our most historic sacred sites was part of the Spotsin Reserve and was to be included in the land. So basically the government had gone on, you know, for 30 years they didn't give, you know, the Spotsin an answer back about that. And so they did eventually put that into the lands of the Spotsin First Nation. However, it had been in like order and council, and there had been reference to it within the Royal Commission and other documents, and lots of paper, you know, evidence that was actually done. And then in 1939, there was one government official that had basically made the government had made the decision, you know, that they were going to cancel that. So that was written on the papers, canceled. 7 years ago, our chief at that time had signed us on to this process. There's a process in BC that the Canadian government uses called the fast track settlement process. And so what they did was they basically entered us into that, you know, process in 97. They came back with an offer of $300,000 for full and final settlement of that ancestral reserve area, which was our burial site. And at that point, the Spotsin people had said no, and they told our government at the time, our elected officials, they told them, you know, that they were not interested in entering into that fast-track process, nor were they interested in taking the settlement. So here again, you know, we have been informed, you know, on May 24th, we were informed that our current elected INAC leaders have entered into that process again, and I don't recall, you know, them coming to the community at all, and the people that I've spoken to don't ever recall being consulted that they could enter into this process again. And from my perspective as a Spotsin, you know, member, it's been very clear, you know, if the people said no, why should the current chief and council be raising that up again? And then the second point is, why would they be entering into any kind of agreement with the government or any kind of negotiations without consulting the people? It's well known, you know, by both the Canadian government and our First Nations elected officials that they owe the people a fiduciary obligation, which includes consultation. And that has not ever occurred. And so they're basically telling us that we've got a time limit to sign on to this agreement, that we must go to a ratification, you know, vote on July 16th. However, we don't know if that's going to get the actual land back. They don't have an agreement with the farmer who actually holds title to the land now through the province of BC. And we don't know, you know, at this point, you know, whether it's going to be enough money, you know, to even get the amount of, you know, land back. We don't have any guarantees that we're going to be able to get that land back. And why should we have to buy, you know, our lands back? Those lands were illegally taken away from the community. To date, you know, I've looked at the specific claims process and I have not seen any other community in BC, any other First Nations or Indigenous community that has used that process to get money from the government for ancestral remains. So in my view, we're kind of setting it up for the government to have a way to quickly resolve those issues because they're not willing to use their laws to protect our ancestors' remains.
In the ability to do an agreement and negotiate with the province of British Columbia or the federal government of Canada, the ability for them to be able to negotiate means that they have to have some sort of card to hold. And if we keep calling them our government, and if we keep saying that the government of, like, British Columbia, and if we keep saying that, you know, we give them the power to have something to say to us, then we set ourselves up for what they have set up this whole time, starting with the Nisga Treaty going through and the full municipalization of our people and our reserves, so that we have the ability to be able to do what they do, is buy, sell, and trade land, which we don't do as tribal people.
Thanks to Gunarji O'Sullivan and Vancouver Co-op Radio for audio files, and to Ome Salma Rahemtula.
CKUW's Stéphane Doucette visited Gracianaro's First Nation on June 28th, where representatives from provincial and federal governments were on hand to meet with the Gracianaro's chief and council, and to talk with members of the community concerning mercury in their water. There has been consistent pressure put on the Ontario government to clean up the mercury, which has been poisoning the community, the land, and water for 5 decades. Here's a report from the day's events.
On June 27, 2016, the Ontario Minister of the newly renamed Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation, David Zimmer, as well as the Minister of the Environment and Climate Change, Glenn Murray, were in Gracianaro's First Nation to make some big deals. The community of Gracianaro has been struggling for almost 5 decades with mercury poisoning in their river system, affecting their drinking water, food supply, and health. However, ever since the pulp and paper mill in Dryden, Ontario, dumped some 9 tons of mercury into the English Wabagoon River system, eventually making its way to Gracie, nothing's been done to clean it up. Just about a month ago, a busload of people from Gracie's community went to Toronto for the River Run protest organized by local solidarity teams helping boost the public profile of the struggle in Gracie. Over 1,000 people marched in the streets of the Ontarian capital, and numerous other events took place. On June 23rd, 6 Torontonians acting in solidarity with Gracie were arrested after dumping fake poisonous chemicals outside the Toronto legislature. The materials, actually cornstarch, were cleaned up immediately, the irony of which was not lost on many. Besides the long-standing mercury issue, the arrestees were also calling attention to the fact that there may be even more barrels of mercury still buried in the river, and the province may have known this for months before sharing the information with people living downstream. Gracianaro's Chief Simon Fobister welcomed the community, government officials, and other visitors to the powwow grounds where the day's events were to take place.
We're going to hear something that from Minister Murray, what we've been asking for all these years, all the hard work that Judy De Silva has done, the River Run, all the people that went to those river runs over the years, they walked and they through the streets of Toronto demanding that the river be cleaned up.
David Zimmer, Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation, then addressed the people gathered.
We will take, as the Premier said in her remarks, immediate steps to start the process to deal with this situation here.
Former Winnipeg Mayor, now Ontario Minister of the Environment and Climate Change, Glenn Murray, took his turn on the mic.
This is not an easy issue to manage. It's not like there's just one thing you can do and the problem is going to go away. The solutions to each of the contamination, the mercury contamination in different parts, is complicated.
After the politicians had their say, members of the Gracianaro's River team addressed the government officials and concluded with a list of recommendations, which are to shut down the Dryden Mill, clean the English Wabagoon River system, no trumped-up charges to Anishinaabeg for using the land, do not harass the Anishinaabeg for using the land and water, lower the water table so the wild rice can grow, no logging, clear-cutting, no spraying, treat the English Wabagoon River Anishinaabeg humanely. After a feast, the chief and council met privately with all the government officials in order to hammer out some details on the plan to clean up the river system. It took about 2 hours before coming out and speaking to the media and the community. The ministers and Chief Fobister stood together in what seemed to be great harmony regarding plans for the start of the river cleanup. While details like timelines and markers of success were not exactly being discussed, they committed money to immediate studies to determine areas called hotspots where mercury is concentrated and present recommendations to a working group headed by community members. Though none of this was on paper yet for posterity and accountability, it seems like things might actually start moving for the too long delayed cleanup after all. I spoke with Carissa Swain, a local youth, about what she thought of the day's happenings.
Yeah, like it was a really hard day, like to hear the promises when they've been saying the same thing over and over for a couple times that they've been here. And that's what I'm really looking forward to, is a change in our community for our future and for the generations that are to come to enjoy the water and be able to drink it and have fun in it and go swimming and do activities. And we just need clean water.
This is Stefan Doucette for CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, traditional territory of the Nahiawak and Nakota, Treaty 1 territory and traditional homeland of the Métis Nation.
Over 500 community members walked in opposition to condominium developments on a sacred site on unceded Algonquin territory. Opposition to the development is led by Algonquin elders and community members who wish to protect a traditional and ceremonial gathering place.
Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Matt Cicero with CKCU Oprah Roots Radio. This is a feature on the June 17th Sacred Walk to protect the Chaudière Falls and Islands from the Zibi condominium development. Ottawa, and the entire Ottawa River watershed, is the territory of the Algonquin Nation, and has never been ceded or surrendered. On Friday, June 17th, 500 people in Ottawa marched to protect the Chaudière Falls from the proposed Zibi condominium development. The falls and the nearby islands are a sacred site for Algonquin and Indigenous people. Albert Dumont is an Algonquin spiritual advisor, artist, and activist who has been outspoken about the importance of protecting the sacred site.
I'm also known as Oshkenoden, and I'm here to be part of this battle to stand up against people who would block our access to a sacred site. A human being cannot be pushed out of a healing circle. It's a birthright of a human being to take their place in a healing circle. And whenever they block us from accessing an ancient sacred site, that's what they're in fact doing, is trampling on our right to freedom of religion. To me, the real enemy here is the National Capital Commission, who gave Windmill the right, so-called right, to build condominiums on a sacred site. It's politicians like Catherine McKenna, the mayor of Ottawa and the mayor of Gatineau, and other politicians like that. They are the real enemy here.
In January of 2015, the National Capital Commission sold the stolen Algonquin land to Windmill Development Group to build condominiums on. On October 8th of 2015, the City of Ottawa rezoned the Chaudière and Albert Islands for private and commercial development. The Band Council of Pequawknagon and the Algonquins of Ontario support the condominium project. The other 9 Algonquin band councils oppose it, as does the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec-Labrador. Proponents of the Zibi condominiums have aggressively asserted that it is wrong for non-Algonquin people to campaign against the project, despite the fact that Algonquin elders and leaders say the project must be stopped. Gabrielle Fayant is a local Métis activist who has been part of the campaign to protect the sacred site.
This conversation started a couple years ago, actually. It started with just a few people, and I was often asked to come in to those circles and share my perspective. But at the time, I really didn't feel like it was my place, just because I am Métis. I'm a guest here on Algonquin territory. However, then I've seen elders that I really respect, like Albert Dumont, Evelyn Commanda, Algonquin elders, as well as non-Algonquin elders, but Indigenous elders like Douglas Cardinal. These elders are leading us to be aware of what these islands mean for not only Algonquin people, but all Indigenous people, and even non-Indigenous people, what this means if these islands are tampered with and if the falls aren't freed. It's really detrimental to our culture, to our spirituality, to our well-being as people here.
The sacred walk began at Victoria Island, nearby to the proposed condominiums, and ended at Parliament Hill. Once there, Algonquin elders and activists spoke about the importance of protecting the falls. Jane Ann Chartron is an Algonquin elder from Algonquin Park.
We should have a place where we can go, where it is sacred, where it has been sacred for thousands and thousands of years. We are here because of the next seven generations. Of your people and my people to join hands in unity, to paddle both sides of the river in harmony. And remember, you can't paddle that canoe alone. It'll upset you. You might get wet. We need to unleash Chaudière. We must release the falls.
The Trudeau Liberals have promised to uphold the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, to pursue reconciliation, and that they will return to a nation-to-nation relationship with Indigenous peoples. However, Lynn Gell, a non-status Algonquin woman, scholar, and activist, questions this.
Context of reconciliation and nation-to-nation building, it's absolutely ridiculous that they would be developing a sacred Algonquin place.
Elders and organizers have said that the Sacred March is only a first step in the battle to protect the falls and islands. You can check the Facebook group It Is Sacred for more information, as well as the websites stopwindmill.ca and freethefalls.ca. You can also contact Liberal Minister for the Environment, Catherine McKenna, and tell her that you want her to stop the condominium development. This has been a Groundwire production in Ottawa, Algonquin Territory, produced by Matt Cicero of CKCU, Oberg Roots Radio.
On our community radio report, we highlight the work and achievements of community radio volunteers and producers at this year's National Campus and Community Radio Awards.
On June 10th in Ottawa, CHUO 89.1 FM and the National Campus and Community Radio Association presented the annual National Campus and Community Radio Awards, which honor the incredible programming, people, and milestones of community radio in Canada. The awards ceremony took place during the National Campus and Community Radio Conference, or NCRC, and featured a keynote speech by Indigenous broadcaster and comedian Candy Palmater. Olivia Goloski from CJSW in Calgary won the Breaking Barriers Award for programming that fights oppression and discrimination.
Hello, Tanse and Salut. This is Olivia Marie Goloski calling in from the CJSW studios, 90.9 FM in Calgary, Alberta, which also happens to reside on the traditional lands of the Treaty 7's people, as well as the unrecognized lands of the Métis Nation. To kind of give you a quick snapshot of what the podcast is. It kind of came out of conversations I'd had with other artists and colleagues and from personal experiences of discrimination, experiences with systemic oppression throughout our art and cultural communities, having conversations with artists of diversity, which encompasses so many things. But off the top of my head, low income, people who are queer, people who are different, abilityed, Indigenous peoples.
Often in disability groups, the leader is an able-bodied person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's always a planned thing. I mean, sometimes it just kind of happens, but I don't know if the able-bodied world has this thought that maybe a disabled person couldn't lead. I don't know. So maybe that dispels some myths or something.
Ome Rahemchila from Groundwire traveled to Ottawa and spoke with Juanita Muenga from CGRU in Toronto after she accepted the Women's Hands and Voices Award on behalf of her station's feminist collective.
So I won an award for Fem Radio, which is a CGRU feminist collective. I host the show with with Emily Dravowski, Stacey Copeland, and Gabby Dravowski.
And what's the show about? What do you guys focus on?
So Femme Radio is really a feminist collective, and we talk about issues relating to women and individuals who identify as women. We try to highlight Canadian content, whether that be an artist, what we're digging, news stories, all related to women of diversity and women who identify as women.
Ontario will spend $250 million over the next 3 years to help understand the legacy of residential schools and to create what Wynne called a culturally relevant and responsible justice system, which I think is super cool, especially the fact that not even Ontario, but just Canada starting to teach the newer generations like the truth about our better like dark past. Mm-hmm. I know that when I was in high school, I first of all had to take an elective course to learn about indigenous history, and even then we brushed through residential schools. Basically, we learned like that it was bad and it happened. We didn't learn that these kids were being abused and just disgust, like they were put through disgusting, like just gross, not good stuff.
I totally agree. I remember actually on that note being in, I think it was my grade 5 class, and that was probably the first time the curriculum was introduced.
Ooh.
And the way that they highlighted it was very, very much from a colonialist
yeah,
perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
So it highlighted why Europeans came.
Exactly.
What was being done to make Canada the Great White North. But it wasn't actually about so much infringement and cultural appropriation and extinction and genocide that actually took place.
My station, CFUZ in Penticton, British Columbia, received an honorable mention in the special programming category for our coverage of the local festival Steamfest in the Park. This is Ophir Horowitz reporting for Groundwire on traditional Silix territory.
And that's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by volunteers at Kootenai Cooperative Radio on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, B.C.
Music this week was by Kathleen Yearwood. Headlines this week were written by Carly Forbes and Catherine Fisher.
We also thank Gunarji O'Sullivan, Michael Welch, Stefan Doucette, Ome Samarahemtula, Matt Cicero, and Ophir Horowitz.
I'm Neil Sorokin.
And I'm Catherine Fisher.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station. Download at groundwirenews.ca or podcast at rabble.ca.